Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Dr. Tom Easern shares another of his Plains Folk essays. This one's titled A Country of Problems. Tom reflects on how the Great Plains has been historically framed as a region of hardship, using the blizzard of 1966 as a metaphor for the broader struggles and warnings that have shaped life in North Dakota. Plus another episode of Our Living Lands, this one titled The Dogs Have Burnt Paws. And we begin Main Street today with my guest, Kevin Howard. He was a commercial banker, he's a deep thinker, a U.S. Army veteran, and he's now written Onward at Last, the 2024 presidential election edition. Kevin, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Main Street.
Craig, thank you so much for inviting me today. Looking forward to talking to you and your audience.
Kevin, your book examines the core American values, I think, talks about independence, competition, self-interest, things that have led to social really divisions and systematic inequalities in our country. You've spent a career in banking, and now, Kevin, you've written this manifesto against, it seems to me, the very system where you once worked. Was there a particular aha moment that you've made to step back and say, hey, wait a minute, I've been part of this problem? Or is this book been simmering in you for years, just waiting for the right moment to disrupt the status quo?
What a wonderful question, Craig. Thank you for asking it. Yeah, I did have an aha moment. I would characterize it as a crisis moment. But before I get to that crisis moment, let me just give you a little bit of the background. So I am a second generation American. My mother was born and raised in Panama and came here and is a naturalized American citizen. So she had a passionate love and has a passionate love for America. And she raised me and my brother to passionately understand what the opportunity and what the blessing it is to be born in the United States relative to other places. So I grew up totally vested in the American dream, you know, and so it was a natural thing for me at 18 to join the military and serve active duty as a member of NATO to start my adult life. Okay. So I was excited about being an American. I was excited about this opportunity. You know, I believed firmly in freedom and independence and the importance of advancing, you know, self-interest and the virtues of competition and all that stuff. And, you know, if you play by the rules and stuff like that, you know, you earn the keep that you generate. And so I did that. I set about building a life, you know, in pursuit of the great American middle-class dream. And then I achieved it. I mean, I had a successful career, happy marriage, kids, toys, money in the bank, big house, the whole nine yards. And the crisis moment that hit me was, all of a sudden, after doing all of that, I found it to be hollow and empty, a lack of purpose, right? And it was a frightening moment to me, because I'm like, I've lived my whole life doing the things that I thought I was supposed to do, perfecting my craft. And now that I'm here and I'm supposed to be at the moment of enjoying it, it doesn't mean a lot. What, it's just another deal. It's just another deposit in the bank account, you know? And that set me off on a 10-year journey to figure out, okay, if everything that I had thought up to this moment had led me to a point of hollowness, emptiness, lack of purpose, clearly I didn't know who I am. I didn't know what I valued. And so I wanted to reassess that. And I did. And I went through this, it took me 10 years. And I continued on with my life. I didn't, abandon my job or something and go on a mountaintop. And after 10 years of deep discernment, I started to discover that the virtues and the narratives that I had been told that had guided my life up to that point, right, had proven to be untrue, particularly as it relates to my actual lived experiences. And that what I was suffering, that hollowness that I felt, was actually, there's a phrase for it, it's called cognitive dissonance. When you frame your beliefs in such a way that they conflict directly with your actual lived experience, this is what happens, right? And because, so I give you an example. as an American, there is no more core value than independence. And so we, at the heart of the American dream is to aspire for financial independence. But the reality is, in terms of how we actually live, no one lives independently. In fact, nothing in nature lives independently. We don't make the air we breathe. We don't make the water we drink. We don't make the food we eat. I can go on. We don't make the houses we live in, on and on and on. We live every day and contribute every day to our well-being, but how we survive is a function of the contributions of thousands of people we'll never know, and a natural environment that we have no control over. So once I realized that the problem that I had faced in my crisis moment is that the virtues that had led me to that moment that I measured success by were not serving me, were not consistent with how I was actually living, I decided to align my life with how I was actually living. And how do I live? I live interdependently on the rest of humanity and the natural environment that sustains us. And when I looked around, I found there was a lot of people, particularly here in the States, who are doing well, who are also unhappy and not exactly sure why. So I started writing these commentaries in Onward at Last to use our shared experiences to be a breadcrumb to other people who also are feeling hollow in their careers and where they are in their lives, as a breadcrumb, a first step of discovery that the answer to that hollowness is staring at them in the mirror, and that if they got right with who they are, what they truly value, and they align it with the wisdom of their actual lived experiences, they too could find purpose that leads to fulfillment.
Kevin, I think a lot of people don't think of interdependence. They think of exactly where your mind was 10 years ago. I need to provide for my family. Nobody else will. I need to make sure I have my truck. No one else is going to buy it. They don't consider themselves as interdependent on society, like you had just talked about as well. So what do you suggest people should do to begin to embrace interdependence in their daily lives?
It's so important for this not to be another should. Culturally, we should on ourselves all the time. So for the listeners, I'm not offering you something you should do. Whether you do this or not is based on whether it resonates with you. And so what I'm saying here basically is this. If you look at the last good day that you've had, or just the last day that you had, and you go through a process of asking yourself, who produced the food I ate? Who produced the clothes I wore? Who produced the bed I slept in? All those things. It becomes self-evident how much we rely on the contributions of other people that we don't know. And that when those people don't do what they do well, this is when our car brakes don't work. This is when the plane doesn't land like it's supposed to. Okay. So literally, if we just look at our own lived experience, we actually live interdependently. This is why we live interdependently. And so therefore, these virtues that encourage us to say, if I advance my self-interest, the self-interest of my family, then I'm going to be okay and my family is going to be okay, prove to be self-defeating, prove to be untrue. Why? Because if the people who make your food, if the people who drive it to the market, if the people who serve it to you, right, all the things that you need in order for you to benefit from your work and your labor, if those people don't do it well, they're not going to produce it well, and this is the kind of thing that affects you in your life, right? So therefore, if they are important because they contribute to your life, then we have to start looking at each other differently, right? Because right now we live in a society that virtually no one trusts anyone beyond their little circle, you know, and this is what self-interest to the logical extreme leads to, is that everyone else stands in the way of everything you want because you're competing with them to get what you want, right? And so therefore they are clearly not in your best interest. And yet we rely on them all the time. So this is what I would suggest to the person listening is don't believe Kevin Howard. Look in your own actual practical experience and ask yourself, to what extent could you do it by yourself? could just you and your family and friends produce the things you need by yourself, right? And quickly you realize, just like I did, that I'm in the big house not because of just my labor alone, right? And therefore I need to be grateful to all the people who contribute for the life that I have. And that changes my entire outlook as to how I think of them.
We're enjoying our conversation with author Kevin Howard, a former commercial banker. He's written the book Onward at Last, the 2024 Presidential Election Edition. The book argues that core American values such as independence, competition, and self-interest have led to societal divisions and systemic inequalities. Let me ask you your critique of capitalism here, if I could, Kevin. It seems to me if I own a business and I want to make a widget, I don't want to make a normal widget. I want to make the best widget. I want to make the most money making the best widget, right? So in the perceptions that you're suggesting, is that a bad thing that I want to be as great as I can? I want to participate in this capitalism structure that we have here in our country and be the best and make the most and do all that kind of stuff? Or are you envisioning maybe another model, I guess I'll ask you?
You know, that's great. Look, there was a time. Capitalism is the best of the economic systems that Western civilization has come up with. There's no question about that. And I have no qualms with capitalism, right? But what we have learned and what has become apparent around the world is that in our experience with capitalism, it's a system that only functions if you grow. It doesn't function well at equilibrium. So you either have economic booms or you have economic busts. And the only difference is the magnitude, right? So a small bust is a recession and then a big bust is a depression, or a big boom is, you know, you might be inflation because you have hypergrowth. So it's an economic system that has to grow. And the problem is we've reached the planetary boundaries of the system, in that right now, through use of capitalism, we are consuming, we are exhausting more natural resource, you know, than the earth can replenish in a year. And this is called, there's a term for this called global overshoot day. And so the global overshoot day as of like 2023 was August 2nd. So by August 2nd, we extract a year's worth of natural resource. And then everything else after that for the rest of the year, we are actually drawing down on future generations. So we've come to the end of the practical use of capitalism, because we need a new economics that can sustain without perpetual growth, right? That's my only issue with capitalism, is that we've exceeded the carrying capacity of the planet, you know, because of how much we are extracting to support all the growth that we're engaged in.
Kevin, you suggest that personal happiness, and we've talked about this a little bit, is really dependent on the well-being of others. How do you see this philosophy translating into policy or governance, again, when that word independence is ingrained really in all of us?
The notion, the virtue of independence, is a construct that we are empowered to set aside if we realize it's not true. I mean, independence is, you don't need the air you breathe. You don't need the water you drink. You don't need the food you eat. These bodies are simply not designed to be independent. They rely on all types of sustenance from the outside. You know, the fact that if we do get that sustenance, we can contribute, is their interdependence. Humanity is extremely productive. So it's not like we just receive from the outside. We actually contribute to the outside. But that is, that relationship with nature and each other is an interdependency, not an independence. So we are empowered once we realize that we literally are not functioning independently. We're empowered to say, okay, if I'm functioning independently, interdependently, how then do I decide a policy decision? In America today, we decide policy decisions by how it's going to affect me. Well, this is why we can't come up with anything constructive as a society to solve real problems in real time anymore. It's because you can't solve real problems in a complex modern society if you only look through the lens of what's going to affect me, right? Just by realigning that lens to how we actually function and ask ourselves, how is the policy going to affect us? It is that foundational lens to the housing affordability crisis in America, to your wealth and income inequality, to access to quality education, to access to quality healthcare, any number of issues, to the fiscal health of our federal government, all those issues. If the ideas that we propose or that we contemplate ask the question, how is this going to affect us? Then that will be the kind of policies that we should then enact, policies that would satisfy that. What we have is policies that happen to satisfy the group of people who are in most power. And that's what's not getting us anywhere, because it leaves the other people out, and then they get polarized, and then they get power, and then they enact policies that only favor them, which pisses the other side off. And we have this back and forth of a nation that's completely polarized.
The book is called Onward at Last, 2024 Presidential Election Edition. The author is Kevin Howard, a former commercial banker and U.S. Army veteran. It's a thought-provoking examination of modern society, politics, and human interdependence. Kevin, it has been a pleasure visiting with you today on Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us.
Craig, it's been a joy. Thank you all, and you all take care and be well.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. This region is deeply interconnected. Everyone seems to know each other or share some kind of connection. That's especially true on the ground here in North Dakota and Minnesota. But for one man returning home to Fargo, that small world feeling extended all the way to 30,000 feet. Here's another story from The Tell, a monthly live storytelling event in downtown Fargo. Hosting the August 2024 event, Cody Schuler sets the stage.
Another Tell founder has found their way to the stage. All the way from Florida, which you'll note by his shirt, Mark Anderson. Mark is sucking up by putting the theme into his title of his story, Two Strangers Come Together.
So along with that theme of two strangers, I actually have two stories that fit two stranger stories. So as I came up here, I was like, okay, which one I'm going to tell? So we talk about small town North Dakota. You know everybody. So at the time, many years ago, I was traveling way too much. And I was at a conference in Washington, D.C., and it was a long conference, one of those conferences where you start at 7 in the morning at a breakfast meeting, and good Mark would go to bed, and then evil Mark would close down the bar at 2 a.m. Two Marks while I travel. And so it was a very long week at a conference. So I get onto the airplane, and it's like, I'm tired. I've talked to people all day at this conference, or for all week at this conference. I just want to be done. And I got upgraded to first class because I was traveling too much. Sit down at the gentleman next to me is an older gentleman, and we both have our earbuds in. It's like, oh, thank God, I don't have to make small talk. I'm tired. I don't want to do this. So we're sitting there, and it was a long enough flight from D.C. into Minneapolis that we get a meal. So he goes, I'll have a pizza, and I need a beer to go with my pizza. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. So we kind of both resign ourselves to the fact that, fine, we'll talk for a moment. While we eat, we're going to be very tired, we can tell. So you make the airplane small talk. What were you here for? Where are you headed? And we were both going into Minneapolis, so we were talking, and it turns out this gentleman was just going to Minneapolis, and I'm coming to Fargo. And I go, oh, where in Minneapolis are you? You know, I grew up in the Minneapolis area. He goes, oh, I'm going to a small town called Shakopee. It's like, oh, small town? I was born in Shakopee and lived there through third grade. Now, a slight backstory to this was my mom and dad divorced when I was 2, and I barely knew my biological dad. So I would see him a couple times a year. Then there was about a 10-year stretch where I just didn't see him at all. Then after high school, we reconnected for a few years until he passed suddenly from a heart attack. So it's like, oh, yeah, I lived in Shakopee. And he goes, oh, what family? I said, well, my biological dad is Richard Plumin. He goes, you're me. No, that's my dad. Turns out this gentleman was my dad's best friend growing up. So I got to hear stories. Sorry, it still gets me, right? I got to hear stories that I never knew about my dad, right? My dad grew up in a family that wasn't really good. He was beaten because the other brother did something. He literally went to summer camp and the family moved. Literally happened to him. And he went to the house and knocked on the door, like, hi, like, and you are? So we're talking back and forth, and I get to hear these stories that just to this day still get to me, right? So the one that I remember the most was back in that time frame, you had your Lutherans and you had your Catholics. These kids were Catholics, okay? 4th of July one summer happened to land on a Sunday. So they took a watermelon, drilled holes, put fireworks in it, lit it on fire, and rolled it down the Lutheran church center stage till it exploded, and then ran like hell. And of course, the cops knew them because they had a reputation of being hooligans. Not where I get it. I'm the angel. Remember that. And so I was talking to him, and it was like the cops interviewed them. They knew it, but they just couldn't prove it. Now, at this point, like I said, I had reconnected with my dad after high school, so I kind of knew the family. So I called, my dad had passed, but I knew my uncle Harry. So I called up Harry the next day after I got landed, and I was like, Harry, I got a question. So July 1956, on the 4th of July was a Sunday. What were you doing? How the f*** did you find that out? We were sworn to secrecy. I said, the truth eventually comes out. So it was a matter of two strangers sitting in an airplane, both exhausted, neither one had wanted to talk to each other, and we talked for 3 hours. And these are just the fun stories that I heard about my dad that I still remember, even though he's gone. So thank you.
The music you're hearing is Langhorne Slim with The Way We Move, coming out of Mark Anderson's story about why we shouldn't miss out on airplane conversations. You never know where they'll take you, or in the case of Mark, take you back. Battelle's next live event is in downtown Fargo, Thursday, March 13th at 7 p.m. at 4x4 on the floor above Side Street Grill and Pub. Coming after the break, Dr. Tom Ezern stops by with another of his Plains Folk essays. This one's titled A Country of Problems. Tom reflects on how the Great Plains has been historically framed as a reason of hardship and uses the blizzard of 1966 as a metaphor. Plus another edition of Our Living Lands. This one titled The Dogs Have Burnt Paws. That's all ahead on Main Street after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In Tom Ezern's Plains Folk essay, he reflects on how the Great Plains have been historically framed as a region of hardship, using the blizzard of 1966 as a metaphor for the broader struggles and warnings that have shaped life in North Dakota.
Comes now the time of year when North Dakotans of a certain age will tell you stories about the blizzard of 1966. which I myself, being not averse to storytelling, might do on a given day, but today I'm going to talk about the significance of this particular tale. It's a Lutheran question. What does this mean? My lens for viewing is the Symposium on the Great Plains of North America, convened by the Institute for Regional Studies at North Dakota State University in April 1964. I have a copy of the proceedings, published in 1967. During this time, Seth Russell, a sociologist, was Dean of Arts and Sciences and director of the Institute, having succeeded Hans Giesecke, a linguist. Russell brought in an old friend, the eminent rural sociologist Carl C. Zimmerman, to organize the symposium. They pulled it together as, in some ways, the country around them was coming apart. Well, things look good. I mean, look at the third mural in the second-story hallway of the Foster County Courthouse in Carrington, depicting this generation, boomer days. People are having a wonderful time, bustling about, doing business, building swimming pools, for Pete's sake. Within a generation later, Kathleen Norris wrote her book, Dakota, A Spiritual Geography, from the standpoint of Lemon, South Dakota. And she was exasperated by all the people who insisted what was wrong with the town was they needed to get back to the 1960s. Well, that was the decade when UND historian Elwin Robinson wrote his influential History of North Dakota, identifying six themes he perceived in the history of the state. We'll take a look at them. Every one is a negative, including the famous too much mistake, which became the guiding principle of state legislators for a full generation. Looking at the 1965 symposium from 60 years later, you'll notice two things right away. No women in it to speak of, no Indians in it at all. Indigenous peoples were still considered by social scientists and politicians alike to be on their way out. What I noticed right away, however, is something out of place. The publishers of the proceedings choose to insert early in the text two documents that were not part of the actual symposium, two narratives of the deadly blizzard of 1966, one by the state climatologist, Herman Strommel, the other by the Associated Press man in Minneapolis, George Moses. Bear with me, this means something, because both writers make the point that meteorology had advanced scientifically such that there was good warning to people in the northern plains they were about to be hammered by a blizzard the likes of which they had never seen. Both writers also, however, recount tragic or near-tragic tales of people who should have known better but went out and got themselves killed. They tell the story of the three coaches from Fort Yates, scouting a tournament in Mandan, buying three sweet rolls to take home, and ending up burning fence posts in the back seat, eating their caramel rolls while waiting 2 days for a snowplow. That one was sort of amusing. Others were pitiful. Children lost between the house and the barn, that sort of thing. What are these narratives, out of their place in time, doing in the proceedings? They are a metaphor. Listen to the scientists, people. Take warning. Things are going to get bad. The Great Plains, created intellectually as a land of letters, was becoming, scientifically, a country of problems. But don't worry. The social scientists are here.
That's our dear friend, Dr. Tom Ezern. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he shares with us each week his Plains Folk essays.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Climate change is making life harder for reservation dogs. The Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach spoke with Grist reporter Taylor Stagner about how these furry friends are being affected by extreme weather, like wildfires, which can happen year-round in the West.
Taylor, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Hannah.
So you recently wrote a story for Grist titled, Res Dogs Are Feeling the Heat from Climate Change. Your story focuses on the San Carlos Apache Reservation down in Southeast Arizona. Tell me what you were hearing from people there.
The issue seemed Well, particularly dire because they had just gone through this horrible fire earlier in the summer. It devastated the community. It destroyed 20 homes, about 2,000 acres. And the person that I found, her name was Julie Cazador, and she's Apache. And she was running around trying to save all these dogs.
I've been rescuing for now 13 years. Actively for like 7 years.
The dogs had burnt paws, and so she was like out there rescuing them, and she was out there doing that, she said, until midnight or so. And they don't have a shelter, so they had to like makeshift a shelter, which is really rough to do, especially when, you know, the world's on fire and you're trying to find a safe place to put these animals, and also people are having a hard time finding places to be.
The animals are like forgotten, so we fundraise for the funding for the pets that were burnt.
They recently got approval from their tribal council to build a shelter there, so they'll be more prepared in the future for the increasing wildfires that we're seeing here in the West.
That's great to hear. Were you seeing these climate change impacts across reservations across the West?
So it's definitely not all reservations, but there was a few, and there was enough in my reporting to see that there was a problem, because while reservation dogs are beloved by their community, and what I heard from many caregivers is that they're quite adaptable. They're very spunky, I guess. They can really adapt to many different shifts in climate, because they do exist in these more harsh situations than, you know, a dog that stays inside. They're almost wildlife. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think of them that way. But shelters everywhere are experiencing just an influx in animals, and they're just having a hard time placing them. And some of them end up just roaming around and, you know, maybe without water. It's getting to the point where if creeks and places are drying up like any other animal, they're having a hard time finding resources.
Yeah. Will you walk me through the numbers on this?
There really isn't one hub of like how many dogs that are in foster care and shelters. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals gave me some recent numbers. So in shelters across the country, there's about 6.5 million dogs and cats entering shelters, but only about 4.8 million get adopted. That gives you kind of a countrywide scale of like what's going on. But as far as like how many locally, like those regional numbers are really hard. I mean, a lot of places are at capacity. Going back to Julie on the San Carlos Reservation, I mean, it was her and a group of Apache volunteers.
I'm doing it because no one's helping their animals, not with dog food, not with cat food. So someone has to do it, and no one wants to do it. So I took on the task with other volunteers.
And they are still, you know, building that capacity. It's just really difficult when you're looking at the scale of the problem. But that's one thing that I think is really important. Pretty much everywhere I called, people were very excited about this work and very like dedicated to it, which was very heartening. It was very like, wow, this is being addressed despite lack of resources. Hopefully people understand like how climate change is going to make the problem worse, not better, especially with these wildfires, extreme weather. It's going to make some of our most vulnerable people, but also animals. It's going to make it worse for everyone.
That was Taylor Stagner, who reports on tribal affairs for the climate-focused publication Grist. You can check out her story titled Res Dogs Are Feeling the Heat from Climate Change at grist.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Listening to In Session, Prairie Public's weekly deep dive into North Dakota's 69th legislative session. I'm Eric Etheridge, and this week, Ann Alquist, we are following the long arm of lawmakers. It sounds like a country song, right? And what we mean by that is how state government can affect local policies and sway, influence, Bigfoot local governments.
Eric, the tensions are real. Should we talk
about? And we've identified another theme to look closer at. I love themes. And that theme is when legislators debate bills that would directly tell local governments what they can or can't do.
The legislature can do that in a couple different ways. One is through the power of the purse.
Because the job ultimately in Bismarck is to decide how to spend our money or how not to spend it, as the case may be.
And there are lots of different pots of money from which to spend that we've heard about, like the Legacy Fund, which Governor Armstrong, you may recall, wants to tap for property tax relief. But there are other funds.
So many other funds. But for our purposes, we're going to hone in on the Prairie Dog Fund.
If a political subdivision adopts a policy that exceeds or unreasonably restricts or conflicts with an agriculture or energy infrastructure project that is required to be permitted or approved by a state agency.
That's State Senator Dale Patton. He's introducing Senate Bill 2208.
It takes infrastructure to produce oil and gas. There are well pads, gas plants, oil, natural gas, and produced water pipelines, power lines, produced water disposal wells, roads, and many other impacts. Without infrastructure, there is no Prairie Dog money.
So that last bit about without no infrastructure, there's no Prairie Dog funding. The fund is made up of oil and gas tax revenue. And of course, to have oil and gas tax revenue, you need pipelines, roads, infrastructure to get the oil and gas to market in order to be able to tax it.
So how is that then distributed for infrastructure projects around the state, Ann?
It's established in 2019, and it was a response in part to our two most familiar words this legislative session.
Speaking of themes.
Property taxes.
So where is Senator Patton from?
Wofford City.
Ah, so right in the heart of the oil patch, of course. Makes sense. So this fund pays for infrastructure projects around the state so that local governments don't need to constantly hit up residents for property tax hikes to get things done.
That's correct.
So how far-reaching is this fund?
So it supports infrastructure projects in non-oil-producing counties, which is most of the state.
So what's the issue this bill is addressing, Ann? This seems like a variation of the Legacy Fund paying for things.
They will not be eligible to receive Prairie Dog funding until the cure of the policy ordinance has taken place.
They, meaning local governments, and they wouldn't be eligible to access this Prairie Dog Fund if it adopts a policy or an ordinance that interferes with an energy or, and this is another political layer to SB 2208, animal agriculture infrastructure projects.
So he's saying that oil and gas is paying for things in other parts of the state, and local governments need to follow the state's lead in approving these infrastructure projects. Now, I could see how this could get frustrating for both sides. The state, which wants to continue to build out its energy infrastructure with carbon capture, coal, and lignite, and oil and gas.
And that frustration was expressed by Ron Ness, who heads the Petroleum Council.
It is impossible to build linear infrastructure with a patchwork of regulations. North Dakota is an agriculture and energy state. We've got inputs that have to come in, and we've got exports that have to go out. We grow more and produce more than our citizens can consume.
But it's that patchwork. That's what gives local residents some power, some control, a voice in how their communities are being zoned. So these are residents like landowners, ranchers, homeowners who live in these areas. I mean, I remember visiting a ranch in Wofford City and the owner telling me she was portrayed in the media as being anti-oil and gas. She said she wasn't at all opposed to oil and gas. She just didn't want her ranch surrounded by oil pads. And that was part of the irony of the hearing on February 13th for this bill. The people who spoke in opposition to it, they're not opposed to building out infrastructure for oil and gas.
We're not an activist county, but when we see flaws in the state law and we try to go through the process that everyone's expecting us to go through here, and not only does it fail, it basically seems to be just ignored.
So that's Aaron Magrum, an Emmons County commissioner, where the Dakota Access Pipeline runs through. He described the bill as,
again, it always seems to be people against industry. When Emmons County had its public hearings to create some of its ordinances or modify them, it was people against industry.
And for him, it came down to process.
Our message is not getting received, and now we get this message back that not only are we not being listened to, but now we're going to be punished for that. And that is extremely disheartening.
And also respect.
And bills like this that basically just treating us with contempt.
So SB 2208 will get a vote on the Senate floor next. So what's the forecast?
Bismarck, as we've seen, can create interesting political bedfellows. Its chances look a lot better because the bill also includes animal agriculture, another controversial issue when it comes to regulating.
So like that's hog and cattle farms in the state. So why is that important?
These are two industries coming together to extend this long arm of state government into local government decision making. Both industries are important sectors of the state's economy, and both are powerful.
You can't outrun the long arm of the law. No, you can't outrun the long arm of the law.
We're looking at how the legislature is debating its role in local government through policies that would tell towns and cities what to do. And HB 1297 sent a very clear message last week.
Members of the Assembly, elections are a function of the state, not the individual political subdivisions. We cannot have individual political subdivisions deciding how they will conduct elections.
He's talking about Fargo's approval voting.
There is one political subdivision that votes different than all the rest.
I mean, he never said Fargo, but yeah.
We all know.
So the bill would get rid of home rule, which allows local governments to determine how they want to set up their elections.
I'm presuming this didn't go down well with the Fargo delegation.
Please believe in the citizens, residents of Fargo, North Dakota, that made this decision on their elections, on what they wanted to do.
That's Representative Hager.
Let the voters choose and don't get rid of a home rule ordinance for one political subdivision by putting it in state code.
I saw our news director Dave Thompson reporting on this, and the bill overwhelmingly passed the House and will now get taken up in the Senate. Okay, numbers time, and let's start with the first number in our weekly three numbers wrap-up.
Related to the Prairie Dog Fund, 8. That's how many counties produce oil in North Dakota. My second number is 1,619,219.
Big number.
That's how many times people visited a public library in North Dakota in 2023. This is according to the state. I bring it up because the Senate passed a bill requiring public and school libraries to remove explicit content out of Maine areas, which is another example of our theme when the long arm of the legislature reaches deep into our communities, right into our libraries.
And one we should sadly acknowledge, a lot of people are thinking about it this week, the number 43. That's the untimely age of Representative John Christie of Fargo. He passed away suddenly this week. The gentle giant, as many called him, is being remembered for his servant leadership, quiet effectiveness, and for his expertise in computing and artificial intelligence. The Republican had close ties too with Governor Armstrong, and his wife works for U.S. Representative Julie Fedorchuk. He also leaves behind 3 daughters. Well, thank you for listening to In Session. Our production wizard, Tate Calloway, is Prairie Public's radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager, and Leah Peterson is Prairie Public's digital communications specialist. I'm Eric Etheridge.
I'm Ann Olquist.
We'll see you next week.
This is Bird Note. The Intermountain West was once rich in native grasslands and in grassland birds. One in particular played an important role in the creation story of the Nimiipuu, or Nez Perce, people, and that's meadowlark.
Meadowlark was coming up the Columbia River and told Coyote that there was a monster in the Kamiai Valley.
This is Elliot Moffitt.
In our language, we talk about meadowlark, what the meadowlark characteristics were, because they were always talking, you know, and they were passing on information, so they were kind of the reporter.
Meadowlark is a talkative bird. You can often see them singing from the top of fence posts or trees. In this story, meadowlark warns Coyote about a monster.
The monster was eating up all the animals in Kamiai. And Coyote was our superhero, too. And this was before people, so he went there. He developed this plan to kill the monster, and he did. And from the monster was created the Nez Perce people, the Nimiipuu. And you can still see the heart of the monster in Kamiai.
The heart of the monster is a small rocky butte in what is today designated as a national park site in the Kamiai Valley of north central Idaho. Meadowlark continues to sing there today. For Bird Note, I'm Monica Goki.
This winter, cozy up with Humanities North Dakota's Book Talks. Three stories, three authors, 3 months. The lineup includes Rediscovering Turtle Island by Taylor Keene, The Many Lives of Mama Love by Laura Love Harden, and Searching for Savannah by Mona Gable. Ask questions and enjoy hearing from these inspiring authors. Book Talks are free, online, and the perfect way to spend a winter afternoon. Learn more at humanitiesnd.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 25th. On this date, in 1918, Frederick Smith was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, to Eugene and Gladys Smith. He began his career in entertainment at the age of 12, ushering at 3 neighborhood theaters. After a stint in the U.S. Naval Reserve, Fred became an associate of Al Sheehan's Incorporated, a company that produced all types of stage shows. In 1965, North Dakota businessman Harold Schaefer hired Smith to help create what would eventually become the Medora musical. The musical struggled at first, with many early shows failing to attract enough customers to cover costs. Fred watched as funds dwindled, and just when things seemed bleak, Schaefer would step in, using his own money to keep the production alive. Over time, the Medora musical gained popularity, and attendance grew, eventually turning a profit. Every winter, Smith would cast the singers and dancers for the next summer's musical and sign various specialty acts, gymnasts, jugglers, ventriloquists, and comedians. One year, Smith booked comedian Sammy Shore, the father of actor and comedian Pauly Shore. Fred explained that the Medora musical was family entertainment and that no off-color jokes were allowed. The first few shows went fine, but Sammy soon grew bored with the routine. He began introducing questionable material into his act to spice things up. Fred had to warn him, saying he would be fired if the act wasn't cleaned up. But Sammy's material only got worse, so Fred decided to let him go. When Fred went to the Medora cottage where Sammy was staying to deliver the news, Sammy answered the door with a pistol. Fred quickly turned, made a hasty escape, zigzagging to avoid any potential gunfire. Now in a bind and needing a replacement act for that evening, Fred called local cowboy poet Bill Lohman. Bill was able to fill in for the rest of the shows, much to the audience's delight. Smith continued to work with the Medora musical until its 50th anniversary in 2014. Fred Smith passed away in 2017. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Avian flu has infected dozens of Americans. Experts say the tools to contain previous bird flu outbreaks just aren't working, and farmers are begging for a new approach.
We are in a battle and losing at the moment.
Battling bird flu on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org. And we would love to hear from you. Email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org and give us your thoughts on the show or suggest potential guests. Tomorrow, it's Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. Rick and I will discover who won the 2025 Downtown Bismarck Burger Slam. It could be Laughing Sun Brewing that captured the coveted title. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.